next speaker is Rachel from Fire University. She's talking about interactive spatial network in Chinese. Please welcome her.
Continue on some of the themes that came up in the last session on open data and transparency and the opportunities for creativity that arise out of working with a very interdisciplinary team where you're the only person who knows art. That's sort of the space I'm working in, but in a very different area. I'm working on hunger and poverty, and I work for a sort of scrappy nonprofit called the Texas Hunger Initiative. That's really just a kind of an experiment that came out of Baylor University in Waco, and our organization decided that there were a lot of people who were trying to do something about hunger and poverty, and we had people trying to address this at the federal level, and the state level, and the local level, but none of them were talking to each other. None of their data looked the same. People didn't even know where the data was, and spreadsheets, I'm happy to get a spreadsheet, because normally it's like, here are these receipts and a PDF, you can do anything useful with it. And we just get really creative. So this is probably the shortest talk I've ever given with the longest title. So it's really just a testament to the fact that this was very much an interdisciplinary experiment. I was sort of tasked with this holy grail of, we have some programs that the state and the feds use to address hunger, but some of them aren't working as well as they could, and we'd like to know why. And so it was sort of my job to troubleshoot them, and being a R person, I turned to R, and this is what came out of it. In talking about the motivation today, this project is really an effort to see what happens when you try to build a model that's actually based on the experience of people who are actually experiencing hunger and poverty. I think there's a real need to build human-centric models, and that's often very difficult because there's a really big gap there. There's a gap in data availability, and there's just a gap in language that we use to talk about these problems. But on the flip side, when you look at questions of hunger and poverty, those are fundamentally statistical problems. They're questions about uncertainty. And I thought this quote really summed that up. This is from a book called The Lotus Effect by a friend of mine, and he says, the poor are the ones who can never afford to have any bad luck. They can't get an infection because they don't have any access to medicine. They can't get sick or miss their bus or get injured because they will lose their job if they don't show up for work. They can't misplace their pocket change because it is actually the only money they have left for food. And of course, the bad news is that uncertainty and bad luck happen to all of us, but most of us have some kind of margin of resources, and specifically an access to support that allow us to weather the storm. So when I was faced with this project of how am I going to produce a math model that has some authenticity to it, it really helped me to be able to reframe it as, what do you do about those uncertainties? So kind of often the rhetoric that we get from any kind of aid agencies or food banks or anybody who's kind of working in this space, usually the solutions are pretty simple. It's like, well, we have a meal, and if we can get it to the kids, then people aren't hungry, right? And that sounds great. It doesn't really work that way. That's a bit tiny, but this is a network that I made just sort of out of the top of my head, that basically you still have your families and your meals, but then you have this whole host and this complicated safety net of programs that are being administered. So we have supplemental nutrition assistance programs, really known as food stamps, and then we have a lot of child nutrition programs that are going to be administered through the schools. We have private charities that are doing a lot of work, but they can't foot all of the bill. It needs to be this public and private collaboration. And then all of these problems are kind of compounded by the environment these families in poverty are living in. So are they close to a store? Do they have enough time off work where they can even get to the store? What about transportation? Do they have to walk to the store, or can they take a bus? What if they're facing an unexpected medical bill? Kind of as that quote says, there's this really big factor of unknowns that affect the outcome for these families that are living in poverty. So rather than tackling that really big maze of programs, for this project we focused on one particular program. So the Summer Meals Program is kind of a lesser known version of the National School Lunch Program that feeds meals to kids who are below the poverty line. And so it's operated by the USDA. And just sort of as a metric for the need for this program, there was a piece of research that came out in January of 2015 that got a lot of press in the Atlantic, and it talked about how for the first time ever, the majority of our school children are eligible for free and reduced lunch. that's a lot of kids who really have need of free or reduced price breakfast or lunch during the day. But then in the summer, that program evaporates, and there are meals there for those kids. And so in theory, summer meals program is operated by your local organization, so it could be a local Y or a library, and they come in and try to serve this program. But only one in 10 kids actually use that program, of the kids who are eligible for this program. And so this was really a project to see if we could figure out why. And the reason for that is that a lot of those organizations who want to be feeding those kids, they don't break even. And so sort of as we had the like meal to family simple solution, this program with summer meals seems like it should be pretty simple to administer. You've got the funds that are coming in from the feds, and then they're administered by the state, and then they're served by these sponsors, which could be like your local food bank, and they come in and prepare the meals, and then they're actually served at a site, like a park, or a library, a school, whatever, and then they're actually served to families and kids. But again, it's not so simple. The government could shut down. Everybody knows politics are a little volatile these days. The state has a whole host of unbelievably complicated regulations that may limit whether or not a sponsor can even get those funds to serve the meal. A lot of our sponsors are just running out of funds. They have a limited budget. Kids may or may not show up at these meal sites because maybe their friends aren't going, or there's a stigma associated with it. And then the families may or may not be able to get there in the summer. So uncertainty comes in again, complicating our network of what should be a reasonably straightforward solution. And so I sat with that problem for a while, a couple of months, and I actually worked like on the field going out and just talking to people all over the state of Texas and the nation, just trying to figure out what this problem looked like. And at the same time, I happened to be working with a group at the University of Warwick that was looking at food insecurity on a really like coarse-grained level. And so what they were trying to do was come up with a way to model these insecurities that could happen anytime there's a food scare. So they used this paper that talked about using dynamic vision networks for decision support that just basically showed where the vulnerabilities were in the food chain. And so I thought, hey, maybe we could do something similar for this summer meals program. And so in order to do that, I just used a vision network. So for that, I needed some nodes. And so I needed a list of factors that were going to affect the success of this program. And then I needed to come up with some way to determine what the causal structure was, so show the edges between each of those. And so for that, the R community was unbelievably helpful. And I found this package called HiDef that was really wonderful. And it's built off of RJAGS, and so using kids sampling to construct Bayesian networks and model food insecurity. So in order to get that long list of notes, I probably spent really the better part of a year going around and talking with Audrey Rowe at USDA, and then talking with our state officials who actually administered the program, and talking with them about what their database looked like and what were their data collection practices. I went and talked and tried to pull budgetary information from local organizations. Found out that most of them, they would like, I'd ask for budgetary information, and instead of bringing me a spreadsheet, they'd bring me like a file folder, like this big. And I was like, great, okay, thanks. And then I'd go through that and try to come up with some way to measure these problems. Talk to community advocates and families, and then in order to determine the edges, I talked with somebody in Monash who does knowledge engineering, and basically what they did was they just, we took a group of experts who have all worked in this program for a long time and showed this cold list of factors that we pulled from all of these interviews and asked them to fill out, to put just a one anywhere where they thought there was an edge. And then we averaged all of those and got this network structure out of that. And then really the third part of constructing the network was coming up with a way to assign probabilities to each of those factors that played a part. And so for that, there was a lot of exploratory data analysis that went off of that. It was a combination of trying to find data sources that could be used either to directly measure that factor or kind of as a proxy, and then try to go through and sort of look at the distribution and figure out sort of how we should sort the different levels that each node took. And then there were some factors that we thought really play a role in hunger and poverty that there just wasn't any data on at all. And so for those, we conducted some expert elicitation workshops where there's kind of a rigorous protocol to put a number on things that you don't have any data for. And so after all that, we got this. So this is all online, so you can look at it in more depth later. But essentially what we have is this network that shows from really what the big determinants are of having a successful summer meals program. So in decision analysis, you have decision space, and so you the next thing we needed to identify was what are the possible things that some sponsor who's running this program could possibly change about the program. And so those are your decision notes. They're highlighted here in blue. So as an example, I've just said, okay, suppose that I'm operating this program in rural West Texas, and I could up my media, I could let people know about it, I could change my menu, and I could offer some public transportation. But I don't know which of those is the best to do. So that's why I'm going to run this model, because I want to know what's my best option. And then the next thing you want to do is set the utility node. So for this model, Total Meals was what we really used as the benchmark for running a successful program. Because if you have more kids who are coming to get meals, that's going to translate into more reimbursement, and it'll translate into more kids who are fed. So utility node is highlighted at the bottom. And then at that point, it takes those three blue decision nodes that we saw in the slide, and it takes all the possible values that they take, and then it comes up with a policy matrix for all the different scenarios that you could run. So here the model's just compiling, and then down here we've fed policies. And so just for computational simplicity, each of the decision nodes had two values. And so here, that made for a total of 8 different scenarios that we could run through this model. So you see the options there. For public transportation, menu quality, and media. And then the next step is to sample that and find what the maximum expected utility is. And so here I've sampled each one of my policies to see which of those gives me the best policy. So you see that in this instance, scenario 4 had the highest expected utility, and so that means that for this scenario, your best solution is to make public transport available, and then have a high meal quality, and then low media. So how that might translate to a sponsor running this program is that they might prioritize, they all have a limited budget, but they could prioritize making transportation available and really making their meals tasty to kids. So you also notice that all these are, they're really quite close. So in thinking about how we communicated this model to stakeholders, we never showed them the numbers because I think we need some more questions than there were, and we didn't want people to interpret that as, I'm going to get 1.6 extra kids for my programmatic changes that we make. It's really not a measure of that. It's just that indicator of utility. The original model of this, and kind of what made it different from a lot of projects that I've worked on before, was that the measure of success was really just how can we find a way that to prompt conversation and prompt other decisions for people who are operating this program. And what we wanted to do was sort of give policymakers the chance to sort of play with the model and sort of see what their changes might make. And so towards that end, made a shiny site, which is on the cheap version of Shiny, and so maybe I should get one of those nonprofit licenses. Anyway, here we go. Yes, this is the model. There was a very strong preference for just needing to differentiate the urban and rural aspects, so you can select what area you live in. This is very much framed towards sponsors who are actually operating this program, and then just step 2 sort of describes the decision space, and then you can come down here and sort of select your options, which will be highlighted in the network. And then your best case scenario just shows up here. So we don't even show that expected utility or get into that. We just say, okay, and it's going to seem like everything low. And then for stakeholders, we really wanted to make that translatable. And so we sort of might outline some action steps, connected them with our field staff, who actually tell them, okay, how do I keep my activity and my food costs low? Anyway, so that's the interactive bit of this, and I'll just say really briefly that the neat thing about this was, to borrow from Tori's box, all models are wrong, this model is very wrong, but it is useful because right now we have child nutrition reauthorization up for debate in the House, and so the government is currently considering additional funds for transportation waivers, and so this website sort of provides them a chance to get in and sort of play with it and see how it might be, what they should prioritize.
questions?
Now let's thank Rachel again.